Why should the church have a ministerial conference? Is it just a vacation for the ministers to go down and take it easy and sit back and have a lot of special treats and goodies? Is there a value to the ministers meeting in this way? We've heard recently, and I'll just say, just to let you know, that we had no Star Trek parodies. Didn't have any line dance lessons. That we've not been following the example of various government agencies and the kind of conferences that they have had that we've heard of recently. But why should the church have or go to the expense of a ministerial conference? Money is important. Money is tight. We have a smaller group. We have a smaller budget. What is the value? Well, this morning, I hope that I can take some time to help you understand a little bit more about how that has been a valuable use of our resources. And what I plan to do is to review some of the highlights of the conference and try to emphasize to you the important value of the conference to the church. It's not just a playtime for elders. It is something that is very important and useful for the church in general. I do want to thank all of you who prayed about the conference and for the safe travel of the elders and wives and for the success of the conference. It certainly was very successful. By the way, speaking of expense and so on, the church provided airfare and a hotel room and a certain amount of money per day. I think it was about $40 per day, per diem, for the minister's expenses. Our wives went at our own expense. And because of that, some of the elders or pastors only did not bring their wives with them. We live close enough. We were able to work it out so that my wife was able to attend, and I'm very thankful for that. But that was one of the ways in which the cost of the conference was kept to a minimum. Also, all of the non-salaried elders paid their own way completely for their airfare, for their hotel rooms, for their meals. That was all at their own expense. And many of our elders were able to go ahead and make that trip. But let me start just by listing for you some good reasons and some good outcomes from the ministerial conference. It was, first of all, an educational opportunity for the ministry. The ministry is like any other profession. We need to continue our training and our education so that we can learn to do our job more effectively. We were given a great deal of information. In the 2 full days of the conference, there were 9.5 hours of presentations and instruction. And much of that came in the form of encouragement and exhortation to acknowledge the work that the ministry does. But, you know, in doing that, those who are listening carefully, as you might experience as well, when you receive encouragement, sometimes that also, it does give you that sense of having more hope, but it's also a form of correction. Because as we are encouraged, as we're encouraged for what we are doing, we individually might recognize, you know what, I may not be quite up to the level I should be in any particular given area. So the encouragement, the instruction, the exhortation also came with some correction. It is much more effective for us to have the opportunity to focus on the work of the ministry as a group and to do it in person than to always do it via written type press. We have other media for communicating with the elders, but it's helpful to be together at times to receive that instruction. So that's one advantage, that it does help the ministry continue to receive information to help in becoming more effective. Secondly, it strengthens us as a ministry. It helps us to work together more effectively. All of us in the ministry now have a number of responsibilities that we didn't have before. When the church was bigger and we had huge departments that did all the writing and all the publications and all the media and all the different aspects of doing the work, it was structured differently. Now, all of us in the ministry have more than one job, and we are learning some of those jobs. So it helps us to work more together more effectively by having an opportunity to be together. My situation is probably no more than what others have, probably less than what others. In addition to being the pastor, I also work on the doctrine committee. I'm on one of the Life, Hope, and Truth writing teams. I'm on a ministerial journal writing team. And I also help with review of booklets before they're published. So there's just a whole stack used to be an inbox and outbox on my desk. Now there are 5 inboxes, and not as much goes to the outbox as I wish. But it helps us, again, to learn to work together by being able to spend time together in sharing our observations and our experiences as part of these newly formed teams. It also strengthens the ministry through our bond now of fellowship. We do work together. We are a team, and there is a sense by being together of a renewed commitment and an encouragement by being able to spend that time. We have many responsibilities in common, and you might be surprised, or maybe not, most of our conversation in fellowship involves talking about our areas and how we work with our situations and what others are doing and how they organize their congregations, how they work with the teens, how they work with the young adults, how they do Bible studies. We share information. And again, there's no way that can be done all by email or telephone calls. We're just not all thrown together in that way. And the focus of the ministry is on the ministry. And in we're very much aware of, and we look to others for counsel, for input in how we can do our jobs better. So there's a lot of exchange of ideas that takes place when we're in that kind of environment. In general, just as a general statement, it's a very motivational opportunity and situation. It gives each one of us, and I heard this said many times and certainly felt it myself, a renewed sense of commitment to the responsibilities that we have. And in that sense, it was a very positive time, if just for that alone, besides the other advantages or benefits that we've had. Those are general benefits to the ministry, and I think that as the ministry is benefited in those ways, certainly the congregations are, the church is in general. This was the second official conference of the COGWA ministry. Last June, we had a meeting as well in 2012. In a way, it's the third conference, if you count the one that was in January of 2011, when we first were starting out. That was very different because it was kind of a sense of trying to figure out where we were and what needed to be done and how we could possibly begin. This conference, again, the second official conference, it sounds like an overused phrase, but I don't know what else to say. It was the best we've ever had. It was the best ever. Or certainly the best that I can remember of any conferences at any point with whatever organization as far as being in the ministry is concerned. So it was just very successful on every level from all that I could see and from all the comments I heard from others as well. In fact, the board of directors, the ministerial board of directors, met the day after the conference concluded, and they had spoke with one of them later that afternoon. They've already decided that we really need to have a conference again next year if resources are available. So it's always optional and depends on the financial needs as a whole. Rather than give you a chronological diary of the time we were there, I'm going to summarize my comments around three major themes that emerged as the conference continued. Others may pick other themes or lessons that they gained from. I know that you'll also pick up a lot from Rani. She will have other observations or perhaps express them somewhat differently. I don't mean to overlook anything, but unless I were to take the next 2.5 days and just walk you through everything that was said, then there's no other way for me to summarize than to do it in a more general way. There is, by the way, at the information table, a copy of the brochure that was given to the ministry. I put it out there. You can look at it if you'd like. It shows a copy of the schedule of the meetings for the 2 days, some details as far as other activities and other announcements that were necessary, and also a list of all the elders and their wives who attended the conference. So I thought you might at least want to look at that and get a feel for it from that perspective. So the title I've given to the sermon this morning, this kind of a general overview, is Conference 2013-Unity, Service, and Doctrine. Conference 2013, Unity, Service, and Doctrine. And I spent an unnecessarily long period of time trying to figure out what order to put those words in. And I decided it doesn't matter, because all three of those were major themes, and all of them were important and a very important aspect of the conference. I will talk about them in that order, though. I'll discuss, first of all, and I've already touched on this to some extent, but the idea of unity, the value and the importance of a unified ministry. It always is highlighted, and by the way, I think that you have we all have a similar experience when we attend the Feast of Tabernacles. We see some of these very same benefits that I'll be speaking of today that we all experience when we have that opportunity to be together for the Feast of Tabernacles. So first of all, we'll talk about the value and importance of a unified ministry. To me, that was one of the really encouraging and uplifting aspect of the whole situation. For Randy and I, the conference started at 3:45 a.m. last Sunday. That's when we struggled out of bed and made our way to the airport, and thanks to Mr. and Mrs. Martin, got some help there as well. But we had an early flight, and I have to admit that as I literally struggled out of bed that Sunday morning and traipsed on down to the airport, it was difficult at that moment to be excited about the conference. I don't usually sleep on an airplane, but I did between Pittsburgh and Atlanta, where we landed for a connecting flight. But things really began to pick up, and I began to have that conference feel in Atlanta as we were there waiting for our connecting flight to Dallas. You know how it is I was sitting in the waiting area just looking and reading something, and someone walked by very quickly and kind of caught my eye, and you kind of glance over, and this happens all the time. You see somebody that looks like somebody else. And you look again, that person looks just like my Uncle Bill, you know, whatever. So I did a little double take as this person walked by, and I thought, that sure looks like Janelle Johnson. That is Janelle Johnson. And she was scampering across the waiting area, and just in a moment, in a flash, she was hugging some other woman. And it was Lois Hafley, Jim Hafley's wife. And they were jabbering and all excited to see each other, and Mr. Johnson came and joined them as well. And just at that time, just at that moment, a group of five other people stood up in the other end of the waiting area and came across to join the Hafleys and the Johnsons. These were elders and one person's wife from Latin America. And they had flown all night long from down in South America to get to Atlanta, waiting another 3 hours there to catch their flight to Dallas. And so Randy and I, of course, quickly joined them. And so we began our family reunion in the concourse at the Atlanta airport. And it suddenly began to feel like the conference was beginning. And Mr. Langarica was one of the people that was there. Saul Langarica is our pastor in Chile. And I feel a very kind of a special closeness to him and to his wife. Mr. Langarica and I were both in the pastoral training program in Cincinnati in January of 2010. And that was the beginning of some very trying times, and we often share our memories of that training program and the number of pastors who also were involved in it who are with us here in Cagua. There was one man there as well, Fermin Nain, and Mr. Nain, I believe, is from one of the congregations. I'd have to go back and look. I've forgotten. I think it might be Argentina somewhere. And he doesn't speak English. But he was just as happy, and he was jabbering away in Spanish as we were all gathered around. And, of course, others were helping him, translating for him. And then we all piled into a van together that was sent to take us to the hotel. And we were picked up by Eric Jones. As some of you know Eric from the Akron area. And already it was just like a homecoming, just being with friends, people that we were anxious and glad to see so soon, so quickly. By the way, as we boarded that flight from Atlanta to Dallas, I looked around and saw the other nine pastors and wives, and I thought, no problem with this flight. This one is going to make it just fine. So we arrived at the hotel about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the lobby was already buzzing with dozens of elders and wives. Yeah, I kind of stand back at a time like that and try to look at that scene from the point of view of the staff at the hotel and what they might think of us, because as we were there, we saw other conferences come and go, but nobody quite as loud and as brotherly as we were. Many of those who were there we've known going back to our college days, more than 44 decades ago now. Others we've served with in different areas, different responsibilities, or in different church areas, met at different previous conferences. And many of those that we saw, we hadn't seen for many years. As you go to a conference, you'll often wind up spending some time with some people and not so much time with others. And so this year we saw several that we didn't spend much time with at previous conferences. We briefly saw Mr. and Mrs. Neff, and they, of course, passed their greetings to all of you. Mr. Neff looks very, very good, very healthy, very strong. I don't think there's any problem there. And Mr. Neff's father, Leroy Neff, was also there, and I'll get to that in just a couple of minutes. So they certainly wanted to send their greetings on to you. We spent quite a bit of time at this conference with a couple of men that we knew from Portland, Oregon, many years ago, who had recently been ordained. Ron McNeil and Craig Wogelmuth and their wives were there. And they seemed a little bit wide-eyed and overwhelmed because they had both just recently been ordained within the last few months. And they were excited to be there, but really didn't know what to expect. So it was good to be able to spend some time with them and help them become a little more comfortable in the setting. Turn to Acts 1, verse 14. This is a phrase that we often use, and we look at it carefully, because we don't want it to become something that is overused or trite, because this is the scene that we had as the conference was opening last Sunday. Acts 1, verse 14, it says in this case that these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication. A completely different setting. These were the disciples, 120 altogether, 12 who, or 11 who were chosen to be apostles, but with the other disciples as well. The key phrase, of course, is one accord. We talk about that often, but we experience it at times as well. And it is so refreshing. It is so positive. It is so encouraging. In this group, we certainly were of the same mind. And the word literally means, and Mr. Ball covered this recently in a sermonette, it means to have a common consent or to be unanimous. And that was the feeling, the sense that we have. And I hope that comes as, I don't think it comes as a surprise, but I hope that it is encouraging to the members as well to know that the ministry is of one accord. Sadly, it has not always been that way. We've had serious times of difficulty in our even recent history. But within Kagwa, that is the case, and it has been the case. It truly and genuinely is a sense of camaraderie and of shared responsibility and shared relationships. It doesn't matter if a person is from an international area or from the U.S. ministry or a headquarters staff or administrator, a local elder, all, whether recently ordained or many years of experience, all were there for the same reason. There's no grasping for authority. There's no election going on. There's no vying for positions. We were there to be taught how to do our jobs more effectively, and that's what we shared. You've seen those qualities as well. And when you travel to other feast sites and you perhaps see ministers you've not known before, I hope that you feel comfortable with them and you can feel close to them very easily, very naturally. It's because we have that same spirit and God has blessed us with that way, in that way. One of the highlights came on at the end of the first day of the meetings. There was a special tribute to six of the pastors who have served for 50 years or more in the ministry. And it was very moving because some of these men are in very poor health. In fact, one was not able to be there because of his health situation. But every one of them, names that I think you'll recognize, people that maybe you've known over the years. George Meeker, Leroy Neff, Les McCullough, Frank McCready, Richard Pennelly, and Leon Walker. And each one of those has been serving in the ministry for a half century or more. I believe in Mr. Meeker's case, it's almost 60 years, something like 58 years ago that he was ordained. Mr. McCullough was there. For now, he's in a wheelchair. He's getting his strength back, but he was able. They nominated Mr. Salyer to wheel him up to the front of the room, and you could, from where we were sitting, we couldn't really see his feet, but I saw him doing it in the hallway. He was walking in the wheelchair, and Mr. Salyer kind of grinned and took his hands away, and Mr. McCullough kept going on up toward the stage, and so Mr. McCullough is doing as well as we could hope. He's slowly regaining his strength. Mr. Neff was there as well, Larry Neff's father. He was also in a wheelchair. Mr. McCready was not able to be there. Frank McCready had a stroke 3 or 4 years ago. I guess it was more like just two, three years ago, but he was not able to travel. But his wife was there. His wife came and received the award on his behalf. A very nice little, not glass, it would be a crystal, a little kind of a statue type thing with engraving on it, thanking them for their ministry. I'm sure there'll be a picture of it in One Accord. That was a very moving tribute, and everyone really appreciates the service of those that have gone before us in that way. So all of that added to and gave us the sense of a true and genuine unity in the leadership of the church. Altogether, there were 150 elders who were present. That includes about 45 or so pastors, in the U.S. pastors. But a total of 150 elders were at the meeting. There were about 250 in the auditorium when you included the wives of many of the elders and other staff members from the headquarters office who were there. Counting those elders who viewed the conference by the internet connection, there was well over 90% of the ministry of the church who participated in the conference. So that was one of the really strong benefits in my mind in the outcomes of the conference. The second point that I listed, unity and then service. By service, what I mean is the work of the ministry in caring for the church. This was the overall theme of the conference itself. I've mentioned before, and we have a little brochure which is on the information table that shows the theme is bringing many sons to glory. And on the cover of the brochure, there's also, and this was kind of a logo that was used throughout the conference as well. It shows two track and field type runners who are passing a baton. And that was kind of a sub-theme of the conference as well, of continuing to do the work of the church. And in this case, kind of symbolizing from one generation to another, to remember what the responsibilities are and the opportunity we have as a ministry to serve the church. I'll highlight a few comments that were made in some of the presentations. Mr. Franks pointed out that it's been about now 2.5 years since CAGWA was formed, and we don't want to take for granted how much God has blessed the church in that period of time. I remember well December of 2010 and January of 2011. It was an exciting and a kind of a worrisome time at the same time. In January 2011, when we met in Louisville, for the first time, we had no organization. We had no money. We didn't even have a name. We had nothing as an organization in January of 2011. What we did have was a faithful group of church members. We had about 50 or so unemployed ministers. And we had God's blessing. And that, of course, was the most important. And what God has done for us, and again, you know, we're accustomed, whether we go back to the Worldwide Church of God or more recently to the United Church of God, we're accustomed to having this framework, this stability, this organization, this structure. But we went from zero to where we are now in a very short period of time, and we do have that structure. We do have stability. We do have leadership. We have now even a short track record, but we need to remember how much God has blessed us in bringing it together so quickly. Mr. Horchek commented that there are 109 CAGWA congregations in the United States, 44 full-time pastors. The average attendance for the Sabbath in the United States is about 5,000. Worldwide, there are 243 congregations and 72 pastors, with just over 10,000 in attendance worldwide. In addition to the pastors, that'd be 116 pastors altogether, there also are 201 elders. 201 non-salaried, what we've called in the past local elders. 12 of those were added in the last year. 10 were ordained, and 2 had their previous ordination credentials recognized and accepted. A total of 201. Mr. Horchek commented that everything looked neat and tidy, and the nice round number, we had 200 elders, and then somebody went and ordained another guy. We met number 201. His name is John Quast. He's from the upper Midwest, where he was recently ordained. Mr. Lovelady, our treasurer, gave us an update as well. He commented that the income remains stable. It's not a huge amount of money as the church goes. In fact, there's less money for the total income in the church now than there used to be for individual departments back in Worldwide Church of God days. Just under about $9.7 million is the projected income for this current calendar year, which is the same as was the income last year. He pointed out that the financial audit, which is done by an outside CPA firm, that is not someone part of the church, but an outside firm, so that is done objectively, gives the church what they call an unqualified opinion. And in accounting speak, that means that the church is financially sound and the records are all truthful. So there's without any qualifications or exception, their opinion is that the church's finances are stable. So it's important to receive that kind of a rating from an outside CPA firm. Mr. Kylo also gave a video presentation. He was not present during the meetings. He gave a very brief overview of the development of the Life, Hope, and Truth website, and also made some comments on some plans for future development. But the thrust of his presentation was on another matter regarding the use of media. He pointed out that any medium, whether it's something that's printed or something that's a broadcast, a television or radio, whatever, or internet, whatever it might be, all it is a tool. It is a way to use or to send what is really important, and that is the gospel. The internet is important, but it's just a tool. Radio, television can be useful, but they're tools. What's important is the way we use those tools. This is especially important to the ministry now because all of us have been asked to help write articles for Life, Hope, and Truth. And much of his presentation was kind of a pep talk to remind us of the opportunity that we have as the ministry to fulfill the responsibilities that have been given to us. Writing is not a natural thing to many, very little and maybe no experience whatsoever, but it's an important way for the church to begin to make its message known. He cited a couple of scriptures. We can turn to Romans 10. Romans 10, verse 14. As he read these, he emphasized that these relate the impact that the printed word can have on a person's life. He pointed out that everybody's calling started with something that triggered an interest. It may have been a radio or a television program, but it was also very likely, even if they heard a program first, that what drew them into the church was what somebody else had written. A magazine article, a booklet. Somebody, he pointed out, labored long and hard over their typewriter or their keyboard to put those words on paper. And once those words are committed to paper or published on the internet, they become permanent. They're there for generations to look at. Many of us have read and maybe even still read some of the publications that Mr. Armstrong wrote and some of the words that he put on paper, and that he urged us to have a long-term view of the effect of the work that we're doing, that people will be able to go to those articles well into the future, and they'll be maintained and kept for them. Romans 10, verse 14 says, "How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed?" In other words, somebody had to bring the message of Jesus Christ to a person in the first place. They can't call on him unless they've heard about him. "How shall they believe in him of whom they've not heard?" People need to hear the message, whether it's literally through hearing it or whether it's through the reading of some publication, be it on paper or on the internet. "And how shall they hear without a preacher?" It's all about the message, and that was the title of his presentation, exactly as he had it. It all begins with the gospel. We have that message. That's what we have to take to the world. But it begins with that message, and then we put it on the tools that God provides for us. Verse 15, and how shall they preach unless they are sent? So it's talking about kind of a progression of development here about the preaching of the gospel and those who are sent to do it. But he pointed out this phrase that follows, as it is written. And if you look up that phrase, it's used a number of times in Scripture. And as it is written. And so that becomes a kind of a reminder to those who have that responsibility in the church as they're writing, that what we write is not going to be Scripture, but it will be preserved in a way that others for a long time to come will benefit from it. Ephesians 1, verse 13, he read to us with a similar emphasis. Ephesians 1, 13, it's talking about receiving the Holy Spirit and about the process that's involved in that. Ephesians 1, 13, in him, referring to Jesus, you also trusted after you heard the word of the truth, the gospel of your salvation. People have to hear, people have to receive the word of truth. And we have the opportunity, we have the responsibility to provide that. Each of the pastors has been asked to write 4 articles per year for Life Open Truth. And I'm sure that they would appreciate your prayers, because for most of them that seems like a really almost an overwhelming assignment. Basically one every 3 months to fill the Life Open Truth, to give it the content so that people can find and read and be led to the gospel. I don't know that we're meeting that level of that target of productivity, but we are making progress at putting articles on Life, Hope, and Truth. Right now, there are nearly 400 articles on the website. I think 390-something. Virtually, nearly, by now, there may be a few more. Nearly 400 articles on Life, Hope, and Truth. And in addition to that, about 500 blogs, many of which are written by members of the church, not all written by elders. So far, a total of 95 people have contributed either articles or blogs. And so it involves not only all of the salaried ministry, but also many members as well. So it's certainly a group effort, an important opportunity, and an important way of serving the church. Mr. Franks also made some comments about the responsibility of serving the church. Go to Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. Hebrews, the second chapter. We might begin a verse earlier just to get the context here, but we see that Jesus, verse 9, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, he's crowned now with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. The phrase that we latched onto, that we draw from that passage, is the bringing many sons to glory. The product of the church, what the church is to end up producing, is sons and daughters who are given and brought to glory. Sons and daughters who are developing righteous character, preparing each one of us for our place in the family of God. That's the purpose of the organization and the structure of the church. It's the purpose that the ministry was reminded over and over again during this conference. that it is part of what God expects of us to serve God by assisting those that He has called in their preparation for the kingdom. And there really can be no other more important responsibility. Each one of us has that responsibility to prepare. We were reminded again over and over, we were encouraged, and in a sense, again, as I mentioned before, that exhortation and encouragement, as you evaluate yourself, results in some level of correction, to keep that thought foremost in mind. It's easy for all of us, frankly, honestly, even a pastor, to become distracted by things that are going on and to not see as clearly as we all ought the real overall purpose that we're called to. And it's just the busyness of life and the things that are going on can tend to obscure that. And we have to be reminded from time to time not to let those things get between us and what our understanding of our goal and responsibility are. John chapter 21, verse 15. John 21. And by the way, what I'm doing today basically is sharing with you the exhortation and the correction that we in the ministry were given. But I hope it helps you to feel see the focus on these things as well, that this is what we are all about as a family. John 21:15 is a familiar passage. You could study it on many different levels, in terms of the word love and the attitude that Peter had, the attitude that Christ had, and so on. John 21:15, so when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, I love you. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my lambs. And Jesus asked the question again, and Peter answered it again in verse 16. And then Jesus, at the end of verse 16, said to Peter, tend my sheep. And then he asked a third time, do you love me? And Peter understood, and he answered Christ somewhat differently, as you see in the Greek. And again, Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. The emphasis, we'll look at it for now. Again, there are many ways you can study this passage in more depth. Peter, as an apostle, was admonished to feed and tend. To feed, of course, means to nourish, to provide for, to take care of the needs of. So he was admonished to feed his flock, feed my sheep, Jesus said, and to tend. To tend means to watch over, to care for, and to protect. And so Jesus gave Peter, and we'll see in a minute, just a moment, that Peter passed that on, that responsibility on to elders in general, to nourish, provide for, watch over, care for, and protect. And it's important as well. Jesus said, my lambs, in verse 15. My sheep, in verse 16, and again in verse 17. The members of the church of God are the property of Jesus Christ. And elders have a responsibility to feed and to tend. And Mr. Franks, it's not that we don't know these things as a ministry, but he really emphasized the importance of us keeping that in mind, of the responsibility we have to assist in the production of sons of God. That's what God's all about. That's what his church is all about. We saw the conversation here between Jesus and Peter in John 21. Now go back to 1 Peter chapter 5. And we'll see that Peter certainly remembered that conversation and that lesson, and he passed it on to the elders. 1 Peter 5, beginning in verse 1, Peter writes, The elders among who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ. So he refers to himself, obviously, as one who was there and saw the sacrifice of Christ, literally in person. He was a witness to it. And although he was an apostle, he also was an elder. Some elders have different responsibilities. His responsibility was to be an apostle. But all those who are ordained are elders. So he says, I'm a fellow elder. That's kind of a humble statement on his part, isn't it? I mean, he could have said, look, I'm an apostle. You know, I'm in charge of you guys, so sit up straight and listen. But he referred to himself as also an elder, as those he was writing to. He tells the elders, verse 2, shepherd the flock of God. What does a shepherd do? A shepherd feeds, a shepherd tends. That's the responsibility that a shepherd has. Shepherd the flock of God. Whose flock is it? It belongs to God. Sometimes ministers in the past have gotten a little bit or a lot out of line and begun to think in selfish terms. But it's the flock, the people, the members are God's, and he cares for them. And those he's given a responsibility to had sure better take care of their part of caring for the flock as well. Shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, not as lords over them, but being examples to the flock. None of us as elders does that job perfectly, but we're reminded that that is the job that we are to do. So in that statement, again, there is both exhortation and correction, a reminder that to rededicate ourselves as a ministry to the responsibilities that God has given to us. David Johnson also made a presentation. In fact, it was really one of the keynote presentations of the conference. And in that presentation, he emphasized how important and how valuable the people, the children of God, are to him. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Horchak both played on an analogy of children as parents, of parents as they anxiously await the birth of their children. And many of you have had that experience, looking forward to the birth of a child or maybe a grandchild. And as that baby is not yet born, there's a lot of concern, a lot of care, anxiously awaiting the birth and the arrival, that the baby will be healthy and be completely developed and come to its full term and be ready on the day of its birth. Well, the analogy is pretty clear. God watches over each one of his children as we are developing. And he has a great deal of concern. He's anxious for our arrival in the kingdom, just as parents are anxious for the development of their children or grandparents as they await their grandchildren. So it's part of the perspective that we can have of ourselves. And it was emphasized that it's not as if the ministry is a midwife and we're going to deliver all the rest of you. We're also being developed at the same time. We're part of that same analogy. We're among the children who are being developed and prepared for the kingdom right now. So the emphasis to a large extent was on serving the church and in particular assisting in the development of those who will be the sons of God. And in that sense, we're all on the same track. We're all being developed in that way. And the ministry has a responsibility to serve the church as we all are headed and being prepared for the kingdom. The third point, the last one that I'll spend any time on, has to do with doctrine. The emphasis on doctrine. the role of the ministry in particular in maintaining the truth of God. The ministry obviously has the responsibility for teaching and for providing direction in that sense to the church as a whole. David Johnson also emphasized in this regard the importance of renewing our understanding of basic and fundamental doctrines. He pointed out that there were some who had left the church over the years, and he knew of one in particular who felt that, and this was somebody who not long after this comment actually left the church, but they didn't understand why they had to go to the trouble of going to the Feast of Tabernacles every year. Because, you know, it's all that money and all that time and all that effort. And look, you go two or three times and you got it. You understand it. You don't need it anymore. Obviously, that's not true. We observe it every year so that we'll be renewed every year in our understanding. And we'll gain a deeper understanding by observing those days. The same, Mr. Johnson pointed out, is true of our fundamental doctrines and the teachings of the church. That it's important to review those and to dig a little deeper as we consider them again and to understand fully and completely what the fundamental doctrines and teachings in general of the church are. He offered an interesting analogy of how certain breeds of gazelle can survive in barren and desert regions. He showed a photograph of a desert in the Middle East. And at first, all you could see was rocks and sand and dirt. But then he added some circles on the picture, and you could see, oh, yeah, you can make it out. There was a gazelle. It looks like a deer to me, but he called it a gazelle. And he said, these critters can survive in the desert. And they do it by scrounging out an existence on dead grass and on dried up old shrubbery. But he said, look, that's not the way God pictures his church. God pictures his church as a flock of sheep who are cared for and tended and who are continually being led to lush and rich feeding grounds. So he contrasted the loner gazelle with the church of God, the flock of God. And again, emphasized the importance and the responsibility of a shepherd or a pastor to tend for and to care and to be sure that the flock isn't just getting by on shrubs and dried up weeds and dead grass, but that it is properly cared for and fed. Again, it puts a pretty heavy sense of duty and responsibility on the ministry, and I'm certain a sense of responsibility on members as well, that we do have our responsibilities for development and personal growth at the same time. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 20. It's interesting how these kinds of passages we read often, but in the context of this conference, they just seem to be that much more emphatic and clear. 1 Timothy 6:20, as he closes out this epistle, Paul writes, O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust. To guard means to protect. It literally means to build a fence around. It means to value. What do you guard? Will you guard things that are valuable to you? And he's told, guard what was given to your, committed to your trust. Avoid the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. I can't help but look at that and see what's happening in our world around us today. There is so much babbling going on. There are so many idle and foolish contradictions that others are teaching. And Timothy was told, look, just stay away. Don't even go, don't go there, as we might put it. Don't get involved in those kinds of things that just cause confusion and difficulty. Right across the page in my Bible is chapter 1 of 2 Timothy, verse 13. 2 Timothy 1, verse 13. Hold fast, which means to cling to, means to hang on for dear life. Hold fast the pattern of sound words which you have heard, which you've heard from me. It's really sad and frustrating when members decide that, you know what, the church has been wrong all these years. The church has had it wrong all this time, and I've got it figured out. Or the church has been wrong all this time, and now they find some guy who has a website, and he's got it right. And they let themselves become confused by the babblings of someone who has his own agenda, his own way, and he's contradicting what the church teaches and believes, the doctrine of the church. The word doctrine basically means teaching. And we have fundamental doctrines. We have those matters that are we've assigned kind of a special category of doctrine. But basically it means the teachings of the church. And Timothy is told, just hang on to what you've been taught. You don't need something different. You don't need to have itching ears and go looking for something more interesting. But in 67 AD, people had that problem. In 2013, they do as well. So the emphasis is on reminding the membership of, focusing on the fundamental basic understanding that God has given to us, and to value that, to protect it, to guard it. That's one of the responsibilities. Well, first of all, it's a responsibility of every member, and it's specifically in teaching, it's the responsibility of every elder to teach that truth. In addition, in terms of the structure of the church, in order to deal with questions that arise, there is also the doctrine committee. And the doctrine committee is something that I've been asked to serve on. In August of 2011, I was placed on the doctrine committee. I did not ask to be on the doctrine committee. If you put a list of committees in front of me and said choose, I would not have selected doctrine committee. The day before I found out that I was on it, I received an email. It was sent to 13 men. And Mr. Franks said, we're going to choose 5 of you 13 and ask you to serve on the doctrine committee. So if any of you would rather not be under consideration, please let me know. My foolish response or thought was that I'm in this crowded room with 12 other guys and I'm perfectly safe. No one's going to pick me. So I didn't send Mr. Franks any objection. Perfect example of making eye contact at exactly the wrong time. But he did ask me and 4 others, David Johnson, Ralph Levy, Bruce Gore, and John Foster, to form the doctrine committee. My father taught me many years ago, and I've tried to keep it in mind, that when you have an opportunity, you're asked to serve in some way, you should never say no. So I agreed to serve on the committee. In our first meeting, the doctrine committee chose a chairman. And that was done, it's fairly simple. Some felt that they didn't have the time to serve in that way and just kind of backed out of, didn't want to be selected or considered. And in my opinion, basically, it's a process of elimination, not because of any qualifications, but because everybody else took a step back and I didn't notice. They selected me to serve as the chairman of the doctrine committee. Truly, I felt very uncomfortable being either even on the committee, much less asked to be the chairman. I was relieved to find out, and I knew in the first place, that being the chairman does not mean that I know more about doctrine than anybody else in the church. The responsibility of the chairman is to coordinate the efforts of the committee to help decide which, how to prioritize the projects that we're on, to delegate some of the work, to arrange for meetings, to conduct the meetings that we have. It's more of a coordination responsibility, and also to represent the committee to the ministry or to the president or to the board of directors. So it's not a matter of knowing anything more than anybody else. It's just a position of kind of coordinating some efforts. As it turns out, about a third, and sometimes more than that, of my time goes into doctrine committee work. But it's an important responsibility to the church. The job of the doctrine committee is fairly straightforward. First of all, we review material before it is published, before it is put on the website. There's a different review team. There's way too much for us as the doctrine committee to do the blogs as well as the articles. So the blogs are reviewed by a different set, a different group of men. We review all the articles before they are published on the website to be certain of doctrinal accuracy. Each publishing area, each of these writing groups, has its own review team. The doctrine committee is kind of a final check. By the time we see an article, it's already been reviewed by at least half a dozen other pastors. It's been edited by Mike Bennett or David Trabig. And then it comes to us as a final check before it can be published. We also are called upon at times to resolve any doctrinal issues that arise in the writing of an article. There may be some disagreement among the writing team about whether something is doctrinally accurate, and the doctrine committee will be asked to consider that and make a decision. We also have the responsibility for reviewing and evaluating study papers that are submitted by members and elders. We have had seven or eight papers so far that have been submitted to us, on to the church, on various subjects, many of them prophecy related, or that's usually what they tend to be recently, and we are asked, our responsibility is to evaluate those articles and again to determine whether they are doctrinally accurate. And we've also been asked to write some study papers. We've done, I think, three or four study papers that we've written ourselves. So the doctrine committee then has an opportunity on rare occasion to meet face-to-face. And what we did after the conference was over, we took time to have meetings on Wednesday and Thursday after the conference had concluded. And during that time, on those days, we reviewed three more study papers and also the draft of an article that's to be published in the ministerial journal. So we filled our day with evaluating, considering, discussing the validity of these study papers. We also had initial discussions on a few other questions and topics that have been brought to our attention. It's not really probably helpful to be specific about just what we're talking about, because that creates some fear in some people that something's going to be changed, or maybe some expectation in others. I will say this, that one of the intent and purposes of the doctrine committee is so that we don't have wild changes in doctrine. And if anything ever is a doctrinal issue that we need to express or explain differently, it's taken care of through a very careful process. So we were discussing some issues that have come recently. In addition, at all times throughout the year, we're in constant communication with each other as we're working on various projects, also with the ministerial services, as well as the editorial department. By editorial department, I mean Mike Bennett, who does the lion's share of all of the work for our publications. So that was the reason we stayed after, was to continue to participate in discussions as a committee following the since we were all there. It was easiest for us to spend some time together then. And so far, we've had just two face-to-face meetings, both of them following the conference, both in 2012 and last week. So I hope today is of some encouragement to you. That's what I would hope for, to understand the seriousness with which the leadership of the church and the elders of the church take our responsibilities, and to recognize that this was a time when we certainly got to travel and stay in a hotel and have some meals in a restaurant, but it was really about the work, really about the opportunity to learn better how to do the particular responsibility God has given to us and how better to serve you. So I simply would ask that if you have any questions about the work of the ministry, about what's being done in the church, about how it's structured or organized, or if you have any questions about how things are done here, please feel free to come to me. You can come to me directly. You can come to me by email. You can come to me by an anonymous letter. Whatever you feel comfortable with. The church, by the way, the anonymous letter is probably the least effective. But the important thing is that we, in my mind, that the important thing I want to convey to you is that the ministry takes very seriously the responsibility that we feel God has given, and that you are His family. You are His children. You are the sons who will be brought to glory. And the ministry can have some role in helping to encourage and to help along the way, to tend and to feed. The responsibility is not as if someone's going to do all this for you. You know that. But the ministry is God's way of, in this, the way the church is structured now, to serve you in any way that we can. So it was a very valuable week in my view. And very thankful that God blessed us as He did, that He's blessed us with the congregations that we have, and that we look forward to taking that encouragement to the next level and actually put it to work in our congregations.